from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This morning on Forum, farming, food, and behavior change. In our opening hour, we'll look at the Farm Bill now before the United States Senate. The debate over the Farm Bill has a lot to do with what crops get grown and what winds up on our dinner table. In our first hour, we'll hear how California farmers are faring as that debate comes to a head. And then in hour two this morning, we all know Americans tend to eat too much and not exercise enough. But how do we change our unhealthy behaviors? We'll talk about a new approach to that question. Farming, food, and behavior change, ahead this morning on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The Farm Bill is famously dense and complex, 1,000 pages of complicated terminology involving subsidies, commodities, entitlements. But the Farm Bill also matters more than much of what comes before Congress, because in the end, it has everything to do with what we eat. As author Michael Pollan has put it, every 5 to 7 years, the President of the United States signs what seems like an obscure piece of legislation, but that determines what sort of food Americans eat and, as a result, the health of our population. That 5-year cycle has come up once again. The Farm Bill is now before the United States Senate. And in this hour forum, we're going to talk about what's in the current version of the bill, what it would mean for California farmers, and in the end, what it would mean for our dinner table. Joining us to talk about that, Michael Dimmick. He's president of Roots of Change, which is a philanthropic fund which funds a variety of food advocacy organizations and groups around the state of California. Michael Dimmick, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Tom Nassif. He's president and CEO of the Western Growers Association, an agricultural organization involved in this debate as well. Mr. Nassif, good morning.
Good morning to you.
And joining us from Washington, D.C., Michael Doyle. He's a reporter for the Washington Bureau of the McClatchy newspapers, including, of course, the Sacramento Bee, and is following this debate in Washington. Michael Doyle, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin by talking some about the state of the current bill. And Michael Doyle, why don't you start us out? It's now before the Senate and will come up for a vote sometime soon in the Senate. Just give us a first headline, if you would, Michael Doyle, about sort of what's in it that matters most for California farmers.
Well, the bill that passed the Senate Agriculture Committee by a pretty resounding 19-5 margin will come before the Senate. Senator Reid, the majority leader, has suggested it may be as early as next week. For California, there are two elements I think people should be looking at. One is the package of provisions covering what are called specialty crops. Those are fruits and vegetables and nuts. This Senate bill essentially continues specialty crop provisions that were initiated or expanded in the last Farm Bill. There's money for block grants. There's money for specialty crop research, for pest management, for assistance in overseas marketing, and so on. So the California farmers will fight to retain that level of funding. And then there's the traditional commodity subsidy program, and although California is not nearly as subsidy-dependent as other states, there are still tens of millions of dollars that come into California. In 2010, $79 million worth of traditional subsidies went to California rice farmers and so on. And the Senate bill, what's to watch for there is it modifies how traditional crops are assisted, moves away from direct payments, moves toward a modified insurance program. So California, leading farm state, has got a lot at stake in this.
All right. Michael Doyle joining us from Washington, D.C. Let's get each of your views on that, and then we'll come back to some of what the push and pull is about, not only between California farmers, but those in the Midwest and the South as well. Tom Nassif, Michael Doyle mentioned the specialty crops provision. That's obviously what you represent with the Western Growers Association. Are you pleased with what is contained in the bill at this point for your growers?
Yes, overall, we're very pleased with the Senate Ag Committee's version of the Farm Bill that we hope to see on the floor, as Michael said, very soon. There were some small cuts that were made. We understand that in these budgetary times and the economic difficulties this country's having, we all have to give up a little something. So we can't expect that we get everything and other people take cuts. We have to take our fair share. And while there's some things we would have liked to have maintained, we did actually get increases in the, some areas like research, which are very important for food safety and pest and disease management. So overall, we're very pleased with what's come out of the Senate.
And Michael Dimmick, with Roots of Change, the bill in some ways, it sounds like, continues some of what happened in 2008, where for the first time, or perhaps not for the first time, but there was more emphasis on those crops that were of particular concern to California. Do you feel like it goes enough in that direction? What else would you like to see in the Senate bill that is not there now?
Well, overall, I think the specialty crop title is in good shape, and we're happy about that. But I think there are some important challenges before the country regarding obesity, hunger, and pollution, and the poverty in rural regions that are not fully addressed by the bill. The roots of the bill go back to the last century, and a lot of the thinking that frames the bill is in the last century, where we needed to produce cheap calories. And we did a tremendous job of that in this country, and it was very successful for, 80 years. So the big question now is, what are we going to do in the 21st century with these new problems? And Debbie Stabenow, who put together the Senate bill with others.
Senator from Michigan.
Yeah, who put the bill together with others in the Senate committee, I think are looking at the reality of the House, that is the Congress, the Republican side that's dominated by the Republicans, and the cuts that they're suggesting might be in the bill. And they tried to find what they think is a realistic compromise, a place to begin negotiation when the conference, the House and the Senate, come together. So she did a good job, I think, in framing it. But if we're really serious about dealing with obesity hunger, pollution problems, the bill has to change considerably over the years ahead.
I mentioned Michael Pollan in the beginning, and to paraphrase another one of his comments, that in general, in American farm policy is focused too much on corn and not enough on carrots.
Right. Right. And I think that's what's great. I mean, California is well positioned for the future because we have the best specialty crop producers in the United States. They're the most innovative. They're very interested in they don't actually desire to have lots of subsidies. They like the marketplace. But they also do realize the need for public investment. Tom mentioned some of the things that are invested in, but we need a lot more. I was yesterday spent the full day on a specialty crop operation in the Central Valley run by the University of California, Davis. It's the long-term research facility, 100 years of impact studies of what farming does to the land and how we need to deal with these long-term problems of pollution. It was a fabulous day. The biggest problem we have is not enough money is invested in that.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how do we get that money? And that's the conversation we can have, I think.
Well, let's talk about that push and pull, Michael Doyle, because as Michael Dimmick suggests, a lot of farm policy traditionally has been rooted, so to speak, in those commodity crops. And so give us a little bit of a history on that and how that's beginning to change, because so much of the money in the past has gone into supporting, as I say, corn, not carrots.
The policy is determined by the people who write it. And the people who write the Farm Bill are members of the House and Senate Agriculture Committees, who, and the only people that gravitate to that those committees are from farm states. Although infamously, for those who remember Shirley Chisholm, a congresswoman from Brooklyn, she was appointed to the Agriculture Committee. When asked why, she said, well, they believe that because a tree grows in Brooklyn, she belonged on the Ag Committee. But by and large, these are rural-dominated committees, and they serve a very specific constituency. And so, and they tend to involve themselves in fights that are not based by party so much as they are by region. So that right now what's happened, the Senate bill that was co-written essentially by Pat Roberts, a very capable senator from Kansas who takes care of his wheat growers, and Senator Stabenow, that bill, while very well received by the Midwestern farmers, is causing considerable concern among Southern growers who fear that the modifications to the subsidies don't treat them very well. So the general history of the Farm Bill is one written in regional conflicts. Californians have seen that with the dairy policy. Western dairy farms are much bigger. bigger, much different factors involved in the production than in New England and the Midwest. And that's going to be a very interesting fight to follow, both on the Senate floor and when the House and the Senate begin to negotiate. Their differences is not between Democrats and Republicans, but between the South and the Midwest, or the West and New England.
And let's take a moment and dive a little bit deeper into this whole question of subsidies. As I understand it, we've in the past spent billions and billions of dollars on providing big subsidies for certain farmers. Michael Doyle, that's now changed in the Senate bill. Is that right? A lot of those direct payments are going away?
To a degree, that's correct. The senators call their bill, and note the use of the term, the Agriculture Reform Food and Jobs Act. We'll hear a lot of the word reform because they're casting this bill as a something that gets away from the traditional subsidy, or at least a form of the subsidy called a direct payment, where payments are pegged are provided regardless of prices. And that, and instead, they are the Senate is proposing a move to a sort of an enhanced insurance program that if prices or revenues fall between 11 and 21%, the federal payments will step in and help make up the difference. The House, under the chairmanship of Frank Lucas from Oklahoma, has a much more traditional perspective of subsidies, and apparently once they have not yet acted on their bill, but the House Agriculture Committee is going to move toward a retaining essentially the same sort of payment scheme. And so that's a very stark difference between the House and Senate. It'll have to be resolved.
And Tom Nesif at the Western Growers Association, what is the change or potential change, depending on how it falls out in the House, mean for California growers? My assumption would be that specialty crop growers are far less dependent on those sorts of subsidies than the big commodity crops.
Yes, we are. In 2003, we at Western Growers drafted the Specialty Crop Competitiveness Act. We felt that while we weren't interested in subsidies that protected the market price of goods or paid us for not growing something or having bad markets, that if the federal government was going to invest in agriculture, that they should invest in helping us increase the consumption of fresh produce to make it safer for the consumer, which would mean more investment in things like research, especially crop block grants, much of which goes to universities like the University of California, Davis, for the Center for Disease, for the crop insurance, the specialty crop food safety aspects of it, a lot of research for pests and disease. Those are the kinds of things we felt the federal government ought to be investing in. That title was then taken and expanded and made into the specialty crop title of the Farm Bill. And now we have that kind of investment from the federal government, which goes to the kinds of things we want and doesn't go toward supporting market price. We have always maintained the position that if we can't make money farming our particular commodities, that we should be in some other business. It shouldn't be the federal government that keeps us in business. That doesn't mean that other commodities don't need that kind of price support. So we don't comment on what the program crops are getting. We let them fight their battles and we fight our battles. We have a little bit different philosophy, and of course we have a much different history as far as subsidies go. But to the extent that the government does anything which distorts the market price, and that would include revenue-based crop insurance that would ensure a certain market price, those are the kinds of things we're not interested in.
Tom Nesif at the Western Growers Association. Michael Dimmick, your view on the big money, something like $41 billion that's gone into farm subsidies over the past 15 years. And given our current times where that money, not as much money is going to be available, where you'd like to see money and support directed?
Yeah, well, I think particularly from the California perspective, it's interesting to note that California represents 12% of the nation's population, about 12% of the total value of agricultural products. We get less than 5% of the Farm Bill investment. And when it comes to stewardship, which was one of the, that is conservation programs that help farmers do the right thing environmentally, we get less. We get around 2.5%. So that is a real problem. Last in 2009, there were 4,000 growers in California. 4,000 growers who wanted to do something good for the environment, who were not funded to do that. 66% of them were turned away because there wasn't enough money in the stewardship title of the Farm Bill. That is the piece of the Farm Bill that helps farmers do environmental work by providing matching money.
What kind of things are you
so,
talking about?
Water quality protection. For instance, a farmer wants to build a riparian corridor, that is plant trees along his river to buffer between the field and the water body, which is a good pollution prevention practice. Well, farmers can get cost share, what they call half the money from the federal government, and they put up half the money. Because there's a common good that we all benefit from clean water. That program is woefully underfunded. The new Farm Bill is going to cut that program, the proposed Farm Bill. We think that's a problem. The other huge piece is that even in the Senate bill, where I think there's real sensitivity to the hunger challenges, the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is the biggest piece of the Farm Bill, about $70, $80 billion a year, is
food stamps.
Food stamps, basically, is going to be cut and by up to $4 billion. We think that's a huge problem because hunger is getting worse, not better. I will say this about the one great thing that Debbie Stabenow put into the bill was this new nutrition incentive program, which really focuses on regional local food system, be really good for the specialty crop growers. It provides incentives for people to buy fresh fruits, nuts, and vegetables. And it's a pilot program to see if we can get a real bang for our buck in terms of health improvements and small farm income improvements through this program. So that's a positive thing. And there needs to be a lot more innovation like that in the Farm Bill if we want to get to health, healthy people, healthy communities, and a healthy environment.
And Michael Doyle, how much are people talking about the issues that Michael Dimmick just raised, these questions of obesity and how that ties into the Farm Bill, or questions of the environment, or support for nutrition programs to help lower-income individuals? Is that bubbling up within the debate, or does that get lost in the push and pull between subsidies for rice farmers and so forth?
Well, they are absolutely topics of conversation, and in particular case, the SNAP program, the old food stamp program, is going to be very much an issue of point of difference between the House and the Senate. The House bill will spending more, save more, and take a lot of those additional savings out of the SNAP program. That's going to cause a lot of debate on the floor. The advocates for better nutrition, healthier eating, a tax on obesity are very much a part of the conversation, but historically they don't necessarily have much of a final say in what the bill looks like. It's, the history of the farm bills is a history of frustration for those who want to boost funding for conservation efforts or reduce subsidies paid to the wealthy farmers or to increase nutrition-type programs. And this gets back to what I said before. The House and Senate Agriculture Committees are dominated by the traditional rural lawmakers who service their commodity-based constituencies. So there's a lot of conversation, and it's provoking a lot of debate concerning the issues that Mike Dimmick's referring to. In the end, it seems they don't necessarily have as much influence as they'd like in the final bill.
And what about the issues as far as sort of the general health issues? You know, there seems to be so much more awareness. In fact, in our second hour today, we're going to talk about food consumption and how we can modify our own personal behaviors. There's so much attention paid to that question. But does that get debated in Washington about how we ought what we really ought to eat and how that actually is, in the end, a key result of what the Farm Bill will portend?
Well, it gets debated, and I'd note that when the Specialty Crop Act that Mr. Nassif mentioned was, I believe it's the one introduced by a member of Congress from the Central Valley, Dennis Cardoza, and when Mr. Cardoza, who struggled with his weight over the years, introduced the bill, he made it clear he's got a very personal interest in this. He works on diet and nutrition. It's part of the conversation, but ultimately the Farm Bill is a technical bill that sets, in some cases, target prices or subsidy levels, dollar amounts, and the most motivated constituencies that have the greatest reason to help sway that bill, I think, are not the nutrition advocates, but the commodity groups.
Which is a challenge, I would think, for an organization like yours in particular, Michael Dimmick, about how you connect the dots between this complicated, dense policy, which, as Michael Doyle has described, is dominated really by certain interests, and connect the dots back to what we actually put on the dinner table.
Yeah, I think that Michael Doyle hit on something there. The people that think about the bill have thought about it as a technical bill, doing the pricing issues. And that's really what I meant earlier when I said it came out of the 20th century. We're now in the 21st century. We had a big issue of trying to get people calories, cheap calories, because we knew it, when World War II began, that we had malnourishment was a problem. We couldn't get enough soldiers that weighed enough, had enough strength to actually fight the war, right? So now we have the opposite problem. We have obesity, where 30 to 40% of the recruits can't actually pass the physical exam to actually get into the military because of obesity. So we have to actually think more systemically about what is affecting health. Dennis Cardozo is a great example. Cheap commodity crop prices that are supported by subsidies and crop insurance in the end, those create the ingredients for processed foods. That's why I said earlier that we live in the 21st century and our farmers in this state and many other specialty crop states, so that's Florida, Texas, Arizona, Oregon, Washington, Michigan, those specialty crop states are actually well positioned for the 21st century to feed people better food. So the question is, how do we connect the dots? We get people to think about what we eat as affecting our health.
And Tom Nassif at the Western Growers, how are you making that case? I mean, it would seem like this is right up your alley, right? Because it's you're representing fruits and nuts.
When we first tried to get the specialty crop title in the 2008 Farm Bill, that was our principal argument and remains one of our principal arguments today, that we are interested in improving on the health and reducing diabetes and weight-related illnesses, heart disease, cancer. You name it. There are so many diseases today that are related to being obese or to eating the improper kind of diet that we said we grow the best medicine in the world. Hmm. Here we are basically trying to ask you for motherhood and apple pie. Make the U.S. consumer healthier by promoting increased consumption of fresh produce and making it safe through research and protecting our production with pest and disease investments to prevent all these diseases we're getting from foreign countries that are coming over here and decimating some of our commodity groups. We only inspect about 1% of all the food that comes into this country, so it's very easy to bring in these exotic pests and diseases from other countries, and then we end up having to spend billions of dollars to eradicate them, plus the loss of the commodity itself. So it seems to us that if the United States is really interested, if our government is really interested, if the voters are really interested in improving the health and welfare, that the one area where they ought to be investing the most money is in fresh produce.
Tom Nassif, President and CEO of the Western Growers Association. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to take your calls as well, and you can email us as well at forum@kqed.org. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. What is it that you'd like to see more focus put on in the Farm Bill? How do we go about orienting the Farm Bill so that the dots are more connected to what we actually consume on our tables? If you're a farmer, what are your frustrations about this particular issue? If you're a consumer or an advocate for people in need of better nutrition, what would you like to see our lawmakers concentrate on? The number again, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Talk more with Michael Doyle at the Washington Bureau of the McClatchy Newspapers, Tom Nassif at the Western Growers Association, and Michael Dimmick, President of Roots of Change. The Farm Bill, our topic. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the Farm Bill, which is now before the United States Senate, vote coming up soon. We want to talk about the connection between what gets debated in Washington and what we wind up Eating at Home. Joining us, Michael Doyle, reporter for the McClatchy newspapers, including the Sacramento Bee, Tom Nassif, the Western Growers Association, Michael Dimmick, president of Roots of Change, a food advocacy organization. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Before we get to our calls, Michael Doyle, just a word on politics here. We've talked some about, you've commented about how the food policy in this country and the Farm Bill in particular has often been the domain more of politicians in the Midwest and in the South. Who is playing a lead role? You mentioned Congressman Cardoza, but are any other Californians stepping forward in this? What about the Senators Boxer or Feinstein?
Neither Senator Boxer nor Feinstein are on the Senate Agriculture Committee, which is the authorizing committee. They write the bill. Senator Feinstein, in particular, has been quite close to the California farm community. Interestingly, back in the 2002-2003 Farm Bill, she and Senator Boxer at one point took a position concerning the limitation of subsidies. They were educated, let us say, by the California cotton farmers, and they flipped their position. And Senator Feinstein is, from what I can see, a pretty reliable defender of the California farm interests. Senator Boxer's as well. Senator Feinstein tends to be closer to the farmers on water issues. They will watch, but right now and step in as needed. But they are not taking a lead role. On the House side, the key roles are being played by the chair and the ranking member, Frank Lucas from Oklahoma, a Republican, Colin Peterson, and a Democrat from Minnesota. There are no real leaders from California on that committee in the majority. There are members. Mr. Cardoza is still active, though he's retiring. There are other members from California on the committee. But this is, from what I can see, a bill largely being written by people who are not from California.
And does that concern you, Michael Dimmick, that the politics of this are not exactly something that is in the sweet spot for California politicians?
Yeah, I think it is. It is a problem. It's a long-term problem, but it shouldn't be because we have the largest congressional delegation in the United States, and we also have the largest farm state, and we have the most, we have the biggest, we're the most important farm state. So I think it is a strange disconnect, and it's one of the things that the organization I'm with is working on creating California's first food policy council. And one of the goals of that will be to get this state to speak in a unified voice, both in the Congress and in Sacramento.
And Tom Nassif, just a brief word for you, and then I need to get to our calls, because you're a political pro. You've played a role in past Republican administrations. Why do you think that is, and what can be done to sort of engage California politicians more in this particular issue?
Yeah, I think it's quite amazing that there isn't one Republican on the Ag Committee of the House of Representatives when we are the largest farm state in the country. I'm just afraid that so often there are other committees where they feel they have more power and they're more important than Ag. But, of course, to us, their involvement is extremely important. We're going to be sorry to lose Dennis Cardoza. Jim Costa has sort of taken up the mantle on the Democratic side, helping us. And then we've been getting some help from Kevin McCarthy on the immigration side.
And when you say no Republicans on the House committee, you're referring to California Republicans, correct?
California Republicans, yeah. On the Ag Committee.
Yeah.
Correct.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say about the Farm Bill and what they're looking for in this. We're going to start out with Bernice, who actually joins us from Fayetteville, Arkansas this morning. Bernice, go ahead, please.
Hi there. I was calling in about the SNAP program. I haven't read the Farm Bill, and I'm curious to learn how much they're going to be cutting. I heard that mentioned earlier. I find that to be a really important part of our country as we're changing and sort of reforming our ideas of fresh food, especially for the demographic that receives SNAP benefits. I think it's crucial that they learn that they can actually use their benefits to not only buy plants that they can use to plant in gardens, but to also buy fresh produce rather than cheap commodity foods that for generations they've been sort of brainwashed or taught to buy cheap food with their benefits. So I think it's so important right now in our country that we are talking more about those benefits that they can that they have to buy fresh produce.
Bernice, thank you. SNAP, again, is what used to be known as the old food stamp program. And as Bernice notes, Michael Doyle, those benefits can be used for things other than buying, you know, bread and cereal. Give us the specifics, Michael Doyle, about where the cuts are, both in the Senate bill and, as you indicated earlier, more likely to come on the House side.
The Senate bill tightens, in the terms of, in the words of the senators, tightens some of the eligibility requirements in an effort to save several billions of dollars. Some of the tightening strikes me as being primarily symbolic. For instance, the Senate bill would cut off SNAP benefits to people who make a large portion of their income from gambling.
Hmm.
They also would cut off SNAP benefits to college students, except for those who are in the vocational or community college type environments. Those, as I say, the dollar amount of savings from those provisions may not be very high. They send a political signal, presumably of some kind. There are other limitations as well. The House is going to try to save cut $33 billion from its farm bill. And by cut, we mean that will be $33 billion less than would be spent if the current farm bill were to continue for the next 10 years. A lot of that money will come from the SNAP elements. I am unfamiliar with some of the specifics of where those limitations will come in, but there will be more examples like if you're a gambler, you can't get SNAP.
Yeah.
And there'll be the hoary old examples of there'll be cracking down on waste, fraud, and abuse. From the Reagan era, the welfare queen image will be resurrected again to justify some of these reductions.
And Michael, just briefly, give us the kind of overarching policy that this fits into in terms of budget-cutting policy. In other words, is this all part of the sort of draconian cuts that may come because of the inability of the Congress to come together on this? So are we looking for big cuts in the farm bill because of that overarching need to cut?
Yes, I think in general the farm bill's overall spending, particularly as it will be coming out of the House, is driven by the deficit. And even though the deficit reduction schemes that the members of Congress and the president have struggled with have all seemed to fall short, they are the general notion that spending should be reduced is driving the total amount of money available for the program, and then within that total amount of money, lawmakers divvy up where it goes. So the deficit reduction ideal is a very significant driver in how the final policy will come out.
Michael Doyle again joining us from Washington this morning. Bernice, thanks for the call. Let's hear next from Eddie, another out-of-state caller joining us from the Catskills in New York. Eddie, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to ask you, gentlemen, how you felt about Monsanto's involvement in pretty much all of the food in the United States.
Monsanto's involvement in terms of their lobbying role in Congress, or what in particular?
In terms of how they control basically what farmers are growing out west. I mean, I'm sure you gentlemen have seen the movie Food Inc. from Michael Pollan and how they've patented life and that they own the patents on so many seeds nowadays that basically whatever we grow is a product of Monsanto somehow.
Okay, we'll get a quick comment. Eddie, thanks for the call. Michael Dimmick?
Well, I appreciate his concern, the caller's concern about the ownership of seeds and patenting of life. I think it's a bit of an overstatement to say that all of the fruit in California is controlled. Actually, most of Monsanto's ownership has to do with the big commodity crops in the Midwest. We're talking about corn, soy. Those are the big crops that they have, huge impact on through seed ownership. Actually, in California, particularly, it's interesting to note with rice, the rice growers in California have not wanted to allow the use of genetically modified rice in California because it'll upset their markets in Asia. So California growers is another good example of California growers being kind of on the cutting edge in terms of caring about markets and living by the markets, being careful and trying to be, that is, support their customers' demand. So I think it's a bit of an overstatement about the impact in California.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to a caller from San Francisco. Starchild, do I have that right? Go ahead, please.
Yes, that's right. Hi. I wanted to, appeal to the president of the Western Growers Association you have there. You know, the big picture is here, of course, that, you know, the U.S. federal government is borrowing 43 cents for every dollar it spends and is tens of trillions of dollars in debt with more, you know, looming tens of trillions of dollars in unfunded liabilities. And only Ron Paul is really seriously talking about cutting this stuff, you know, as a presidential candidate. But, you know, if we don't cut things like agricultural subsidies, it means that the money is going to have to come elsewhere, you know, and cuts to things like Medicare and Social Security and so forth. And so the specific example I was wondering about is he mentioned that, well, we spend, you know, millions of dollars eradicating pests that come in from foreign food being brought into the country, you know, and that it would save money to inspect that food when it comes in. And I would ask, well, if the, you know, money being spent to eradicate the pests is being spent by his growers, then why don't they put forward the cost to do the inspections instead of relying on the taxpayers?
All right. Tom Nesif, you want to respond, please?
We do invest in pest eradication. Every farmer has to employ certain pest management practices. Sometimes people don't like the fact that we use certain things on our crops in order to reduce the infestation of pest and disease, but it's absolutely mandatory for us to get a crop that we can harvest that gives us an adequate yield and is appealing to a consumer. So we don't rely on the federal government for that. What we rely on the federal government to do is to control borders. We don't have the right to control the borders or to inspect foreign produce when it comes in. So to the extent that it's the responsibility and they have preempted the field of controlling borders, it's their responsibility to make sure when they control them that they don't allow things in which are going to cost taxpayers and producers of fresh produce additional funds, because the more it costs us to prevent pest and disease, the higher the price of the commodity to the consumer.
We have a caller who wants to take up this question about the role of immigration and farm policy. Jan in Boonville. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. I read a report recently about the impact of the crackdown on illegal immigration on California growers and their inability to find field workers. And I'd like to know if there's anything in the Farm Bill that addresses the policy on immigration in this country.
All right, Jan, thank you. Michael Dimmick?
Yeah, well, the Farm Bill is basically silent on agriculture labor, food system labor, what we call the food chain workers, and it's a huge problem. Actually, I was in a meeting last week back in North Carolina with leaders from all over the country in food systems, and that was one of the big topics of conversation. If for the 21st century, the Farm Bill should not be silent on these issues. There's a big effort in Washington called AGREE, where different stakeholders in the food system have come together to map out what the big issues of the next 100 years are going to be, and farm labor is one of the top three, agricultural labor. So it's important that the Farm Bill become vocal on this issue.
And take us under the rotunda debate there, Michael Doyle, if you would. Why not? Why hasn't that factored into the overall farm policy debate?
Oh, gosh. Congress is utterly stymied on immigration and has been for years. The last large immigration reform package that included elements concerning agricultural labor was the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. Congress in 2007 tried manfully to pass a pretty comprehensive immigration bill that included an agricultural guest worker program. It was kind of a grand compromise. It fell apart, and nobody has near the muscle to bring it back up, and there is absolutely no indication, despite the pleas of members of the agricultural community and others, that is going to be returning to the Hill in the near future. The concerns about lack of labor, the concerns that a crackdown on enforcement, enforcement crackdowns will reduce labor supply and so on, are heard. But the larger dispute over border control and internal control of immigration has just completely bollocksed House and Senate members. Neither President Obama nor Republican nominee Mitt Romney has the heft to move anything. Hmm. And so it looks like a continued deadlock for reasons that go far beyond the House and Senate Agriculture Committee's ability to fix it.
Yeah.
Dave,
Jan,
can I comment on that?
Yeah, Tom Nesif, go ahead.
Yeah, I spend probably half my time on immigration matters in Washington, D.C., and we have been working with a number of coalitions around the country to try and get some sort of immigration reform. We recently commissioned a study by the Terrence Group, and the purpose of the study was to prove that those people who say their constituents won't support them if they support an immigration fix for agriculture. So we polled Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Tea Parties, you name it, whatever the sub-classification was across the country, and there was overwhelming support in excess of 70% from all groups that they supported an agricultural guest worker program to ensure that we had an adequate workforce and that we could control the activities of the workforce in the United States, that they pay their taxes, that they return home at the appropriate time. So we've been trying to convince legislators that just because it's an election year doesn't mean you can't discuss things that are very important.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that, Tom Nassif. I mean, it's a sort of standard rule, I think, these days in American politics. There can be consensus on many things among the American population, but moving that to a consensus in Washington is a very different issue. A couple of emails coming in I want to get to. Eski writes in, it should be noted that the Farm Bill has an enormous worldwide impact. It's disconcerting to realize how little attention gets paid to something that determines nutrition for people the world over. And Tom Nassif, back to you on that. I mean, the classic example of this is the subsidies for rice nutrition, for rice, for example, which means that rice, American rice, is actually cheaper in a country like Haiti than the rice that's actually grown by Haitian farmers. Is that something that you're taking a stand on?
We don't take a stand on any of the other commodities other than fresh produce, and on the benefits they get or the subsidies that they get. But I can tell you that if you look at the balance of trade figures, the agriculture has a positive balance of trade. If you look at specialty crops, especially the fresh produce crops, we have a deficit, and that deficit is increasing as more and more foreign imports are coming into this country rather than us exporting more of ours, which leads us to import products that don't have the same food safety standards that are required for U.S. produce.
I guess I bring it up in part because I remember Bill Clinton talking about how, you know, when he was president, he was all for those subsidies for the Arkansas rice farmers. But now that he was involved in relief efforts in Haiti, he saw the consequence of those. Michael Dimmock?
Yeah, I think I do think that this is a really interesting issue to talk about. And the rice growers, I'm glad you brought them up, because the rice growers in California are a very good example of the types of commodity growers that the future of this country requires. The rice growers in California are very innovative. They do the right thing by the environment. They've done great things to bring species back. And when it comes to crop insurance, for instance, they are actually being quite flexible on how that program would work. They're actually only asking for recovery of their production costs. They're not actually seeking to get their profits guaranteed by insurance, which I think is an important nuance for people to understand.
So just as Michael Doyle was suggesting, this is a debate that's not between Democrats and Republicans. It's more often regional. It's also true that we shouldn't look at this as rice farmers versus specialty crops, that within the rice farmers themselves there also is different points of view.
The rice growers in the south of the United States are much different than the rice growers in California, and they fight among themselves.
Next to Dalen, who joins us from Los Angeles. Dalen, go ahead, please.
Hi. I grew up in Northern California, and I have a lot of friends whose families were rice farmers. And California produces an overwhelming amount of food for the United States and abroad. And I remember when I took World Food and Fiber Systems in college, it was like 50 or 75% of the nation's produce or something like that. And I remember hearing people, they were kind of perturbed that rice farmers would get paid for not growing rice, and people really just couldn't wrap their head around that. And I think people are kind of jealous. I don't know. There seems to be some animosity out there that, you know, wait, I have to work and these people get paid for not working. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, thank you, Dalen. Michael Doyle, why don't you give us a little subsidy 101? As Michael Dimmock was just suggesting, not all rice farmers are alike, that California rice farmers view this question differently. But it's true, as Dalen suggests, is it not, that in the past, at least, farmers could get paid for not growing?
Yeah, every farm bill seems to be an opportunity to screw things up in a new way. what happens is a subsidy will be reformed or tightened, new rules will be set, and then inevitably, farmers, not because they're malicious, but simply because they're profit-seeking, will discover ways to game the system and work around the limitations, the payment limitations. For years and years, there have been efforts to ensure that subsidies only go to the most deserving and are quite limited, that the wealthy don't receive them. And each time, because it's so complicated, the lawmakers write a set of rules and regulations that can be exploited and that have loopholes. I think it's an inevitable part of anything that's so technical and that is driven by the effort to extract as much money as possible from the federal government.
Dalen, thanks for the call. Let's hear next from Glenn, who joins us from West Palm Beach, Florida, and is a farmer there. Glenn, go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Go ahead, please. Yeah, we're great.
Yeah, there's a few things that I've always found wrong. I'm a third-generation farmer coming up, and I see a lot of the situations and discussions that you guys keep going over, and one thing that keeps ringing to my head is North American Fair Trade Act and how unfair it really is. I'm a tomato farmer down here, and I've watched in the last 10 years some 400 farmers go bankrupt because of this act. You talk about, you know, the pest problems and whatnot, and I know for a fact that less than...
Glenn, let me jump in, if I might, and just stay with the NAFTA question for a moment. Tell us again why NAFTA is affecting you and your fellow farmers in Florida.
Well, let's put it this way. If you make commodity A, and Mexico was allowed to make commodity A as well, and bring it over to the border and dump it onto U.S. soil, and say that it cost us $12 a box just to make even for the season, Mexico charges 5 cents a box, allows for the middlemen, the brokers, and the buyers, such as Publix, Whole Foods, and whatnot, to go to Mexico and get it for next to nothing and make 600-700% revenue when not supporting U.S. farmers within, also keeping costs down. FOB is expensive, and allowing for those to supply within the U.S. to supply their local grocery stores, their local food purveyors.
Okay, Glenn, let me get some reaction, because this is another interesting aspect of this. We talked before, Michael Doyle, about that the Farm Bill had no debate within it about immigration. Does trade and NAFTA enter into any of the current discussion about the Farm Bill?
NAFTA, not so much. Trade, absolutely. There are trade elements in a number of respects in the bill. Some explicitly, there's a program called the Market Access Program. It's about $200 million a year. It was originally written by and for Californians. It provides money, for instance, to the San Francisco-based Wine Institute. They'll get several million dollars a year to pay for conventions and marketing and overseas advertising. So there's money in the Farm Bill to boost U.S. sales overseas. There's several types of funding. Then there's another impact, and the caller is making a point that I would liken to the references to rice production. We live, or the U.S. agricultural economy is part of a global economy, and what the U.S. does will have an inevitable effect overseas. Here's an example, the cotton subsidy program. As last written, it was ruled to violate world trade rules, mm-hmm. and in a complaint brought by Brazilian cotton farmers, and the United States ended up paying millions and millions of dollars in essence in penalties, and now is going to have to rewrite the cotton program to avoid violating trade rules. So it's a big reminder. The discussion, setting NAFTA aside, it's a good reminder that trade is absolutely an essential part of the Farm Bill.
And real briefly, Tom Nassif, does Glenn's concerns about tomato growers in Florida being affected by NAFTA and tomato growers in Mexico, does that ring consistent with any of the growers that you represent?
Well, it does. I think it depends on your geographic area and your commodity group. For some commodities, NAFTA has been phenomenal because for us, Canada and Mexico are our largest export markets. So that's been very beneficial. But for other commodity groups, it's been devastating because they aren't able to compete price-wise on the prices coming out of Mexico. So it does depend on which commodities you have and which area you're in. So I think his concerns are very legitimate.
Spend a last moment that we have on where you'd like to see this discussion go next and where you'd like people to be paying attention An emailer writes in about, how about more attention to innovative programs and the use of food stamp dollars for people to be able to use food stamp dollars at farmers markets, for example, Michael Dimmick. What sorts of things would you like to see more attention paid?
Well, I think that's exactly right. What are the ways that the government can act that will improve provide people incentives to eat more healthful food, fruits, nuts, and vegetables, and to buy products from the regions around where they live. I think there are, the farmers market promotion program is a good example. And the other thing I think is really important is that more Americans get involved in this, that every American should make their voice heard on this issue. And I recommend going to the foodfight2012.org website, because there's a great book called Food Fight out that talks about the Farm Bill and what you can do as a citizen to make the Farm Bill better. And if we all begin to weigh in, we will actually take the power away from those few in the Midwest who have been writing the bill over the last several decades, and we will broaden the stakeholder group to the coast and to the specialty crop states.
And Michael Doyle, just a quick, very quick, please, snapshot on where this debate will go next, what you'll be watching for in Washington.
The Senate will take up the Farm Bill as early as next week. It'll probably take several days, take up a number of reform amendments, ultimately pass the Senate's version sometime in June. The House Agriculture Committee says they hope to finish their work before July 4th. The current Farm Bill expires September 30th, so in an ideal world, the House and Senate will negotiate their differences by September 30th.
And Tom Nassif, a last word from you. Do you second, I would guess, Michael Dimmick's suggestion that more people need to be engaged in this conversation?
No, absolutely. More people be engaged. Our membership, we are conventional growers, we're organic growers, we're local growers, we do it all. And so we support any sort of produce that's consumed. But I think the important message today from my perspective is that if we want to increase the consumption of affordable, safe, fresh produce, we have to. It's directly dependent upon our ability to have an adequate labor force. And so immigration reform for agriculture and increasing the consumption of fresh produce are directly linked.
And we'll leave it with that. Tom Nassif, Michael Dimmick, Michael Doyle, thanks all very much. Forum is produced by Tina Lorberg and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.